nicknamed Maritima, which is by the sea. And then there's a place called Caesarea Philippi, which is much further up north. We'll be talking about that place in just a moment. But these are two different places. So when we read about Caesarea in the Bible, it's, you have to have an idea geographically of which place you're actually looking at. But we will be talking more about the one in the north, which we do find, where we do find Jesus and his disciples. Are there any questions? Any other questions for clarification? I would add another thing concerning the landscape of Judaism, and that is Judaism, it was at this time, was a, if you think about it, the Bible reflects a God of creation and a God of the world and a God of all peoples. And as a result of that, Judaism had to have gateways or means of bringing other nations into that religion somehow. And so we have, around about the first century at least, we begin to have the notion of proselytes and God-fearers, which are two different categories of Gentiles coming into the Jewish faith. So you would have had proselytes who were, would have been considered converts. They would have had to have been circumcised. They would have had to have fully come under and adopted the yoke of Torah, as it was called in those days. So they came in that way. They were proselytized. But there were God-fearers as well who would worship God, but they would not fully engage with circumcision. And within Judaism, they would maybe take part in listening in at synagogue. We'll talk about synagogues in a moment. Synagogue teaching sessions, and they would may have come to the temple as well. But they were just, they weren't fully kind of had done everything to be considered fully inside, a Gentile fully inside. So we have proselytes and God-fearers as being categories of people as well that would have been mixed in amidst the Israelites. Were there any questions? No, I nailed everything, kind of. Okay, good. Then let's go on to speak about the last period. We looked at Herod's development. These are some of the places he's developed, he's invested in. And now we're going to talk about Herod's decline. And this, unfortunately, is the taste that's left in people's mouth concerning Herod the Great. He suffered poor health. I put depression. He may have had clinical depression, an official clinical depression. I'm glad my wife isn't here, so she'll break that down into 100 different ways, and I'm just being general. But she may have had some kind of clinical depression. He may have been going demented, has had some kind of dementia, or he may have indeed have suffered from schizophrenia, which is another idea which has been thrown out there. But it's clear that he had some kind of mental disorder as he grew old, and he may have had some physical disorders as well. And that caused a gradual decline, and it also caused a degree of even more caricaturized behavior, erratic behavior towards his enemies. This is the reference from Josephus. Yet, this is speaking about Herod, that he struggled with his numerous disorders. So there's a whole bunch of things, and still had a desire to live and hoped for recovery and considered several methods of cure. Accordingly, he went over Jordan and he made use of hot baths at Calero, which ran to the Dead Sea, into the remains of that place, Calero, today, themselves sweet enough to be drunk. And here the physicians thought proper to bathe his whole body in warm oil by letting it down into a large vessel full of oil, whereupon his eyes failed him and he came and went as if he were dying. So this is obviously a place for healing that he would go down. And the Dead Sea still is a place today as well for healing. I've known of people that would fly over to the Dead Sea to bathe in mud and to dip in the Dead Sea because of these healing properties. I've been in there and I still feel just as bad as I did when I came out. But that's as it goes. I'm not making a criticism of the sea. It was a fun experience. I'm just not fully healed. Maybe I don't have faith in those matters. So he had this kind of decline, this kind of depression, paranoia, and it's in this stage that Marianne, he executes his wife Marianne, and she was being accused, I think it was by Herod's sister, actually, of wanting to usurp, I think it was, and having a relationship with somebody else, and these false accusations got into Herod's head, and he ordered, he set up a tribunal to try and to convict her. So they knew what the outcome was going to be. And during that trial and conviction, he kind of went back on it because he really loved her, even though she was a Hashmonean. And he kind of doesn't want to do it, but the die is cast and she is executed. And as a result of that, he falls into even more guilt now. He's depressed and now he's feeling the weight of guilt for having killed his wife. And he suffers under that for quite a while. And it's this state of Herod the Great where he is naturally paranoid. He cares about ruling, wants to rule. He feels threatened and he feels attacked. So he doesn't want anybody stealing his kingdom from him and his. And it's at this phase that we have the biblical account, the slaughtering of the masses. And this is Herod the Great we have here early on. When he saw he had been tricked by the Magi, and this is the guy who killed his wife, for Pete's sake, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children in Bethlehem and all its vicinity from 2 years old and under, according to the time which had determined from the Magi. Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And you've got that text of the mourning in Ramah. So here we have the slaying of the masses, which falls perfectly into the psychological profile of Herod at this time. Now, how many killed children? I'm sorry for the picture. It was a nice picture at the time. But you can't assume that it was built up like this. Bethlehem was a relatively small village. So it would have been, and I'm not trying to take away from the ghastliness of the crime, but it wouldn't have been thousands of babies being killed. It would have been a much smaller number because of the size of Bethlehem. It makes it no less a crime, but I want you to get a nice perspective of what's going on. So the time scale there as well is something to think about. You've got about 2 years. So it was 2 years from when the wise men came to when Herod actually does this, which is a really long, quite a long period of time. It doesn't happen straight away. And it goes to show us as well that Mary and Joseph in Bethlehem, they would have spent quite a long time there. They would have spent quite a lot of time with Jesus growing up. He would have had to be quite strong if they were going to, I'd say, quite sure, about a year, 18 months at least, before you could actually throw him on your shoulder and carry him down to Egypt. So this quite important, just seeing understanding who Herod was and why this promise of another king is such a threat and the action he'd take. Herod would not blink twice at killing 100 people or killing 200 people. He would not think about it twice, and so this fits right down that alley. After the death of Marianne, he recalls his two sons from Rome. All of the Herods, from that dynasty, their children are sent to Rome to be A, educated, and B, to begin to build up connections with the Romans. So they had to learn Latin, had to learn the schooling system and everything else, but they had to build up connections with people because that's how you're going to manage whatever land you're going to be, and that's going to be your livelihood and support. So two of his sons went to Rome. He called them back and ended up killing them. And he also, towards his latter days, he threatened to kill, I think it was 200 leading men in Jerusalem on the day that he died. And he wanted to do this to ensure there would be great mourning in the city of Jerusalem and it would be remembered. So it was kind of like, you know, kill these people and it's going to be a sad and eventful day, even if people don't care about me, because his view, which is probably quite relatively accurate, was that the people didn't really like him that much anyway. And there was a degree of disgruntlement about them. He dies in 4 BC AD. I've got to switch that round, haven't I? No, that's correct, isn't it? Yeah. BC, yeah. No, it's not as clear as that. The AD-BC line is not as clear as that. There isn't... Yeah, it doesn't start at zero, as we would think. Yes. So, yes, it's not as clear as that. It's not as clear as that. Because there isn't properly a year zero. It's not as though when Jesus was born we have a zero. I would like it to be like that, but it's not as clear as that. I'll take a look at that and check that again, because you've got me thinking now. Herod's wives, Cleopatra. I want to just give a look at his kids again. You've got here Herod Antipas, Archelaus, and Herod Philip. I have highlighted those to tell you that these are the three sons that actually ended up reigning in Herod's place. There wasn't one that took it all. And these are the sons that he killed, and that's his wife that he killed. So he ends up dividing his kingdom amongst these three individuals. Family tree here, you've got Herod the Great. You've got Archelaus, who's an ethnarch. Philip, tetrarch. Tetrarchs, those are become meaningless titles at this stage. Aristobulus, who we don't hear of, he doesn't actually get any property or any land. We're mainly concerned with right now, after the Herod the Great, is these three individuals here. And then afterwards, his grandson, Herod Agrippa, he actually gets control of Israel afterwards, and we see him as well in the New Testament records. So now properly we enter into this is really the New Testament period, the Gospels period. So when we read in the Gospels, apart from that reference to Herod the Great, when we read in the Gospels of Herod, we are normally need to associate with one of these three individuals, apart from that first reference, the early reference in Matthew. So this was the division of land. This was definitely the most lucrative part, I believe, which was given to Archelaus. Antipas was given this land up here in Galilee, that obviously has connections with Jesus, and also Perea down here, which is kind of weird, because you've got two different pieces of land, although this place here was where Antipas set up a fortress. And then you've got this piece of land here, Iturea, which was given to Philip. And the Decapolis was given back to Roman control, basically. We have Jesus having some kind of involvement here, but this really is very much Gentile territory. So the three sons get the land, and then we have the beginning, the inauguration of the Herodian dynasty. What happens as they reign? How do they interact with New Testament characters? So we're going to begin looking at Archelaus, who had this green piece of land here. It was all one district, one tax district, even though technically Judah would have been separated from Samaria with regards to the actual peoples there, because Samarians would have been the other people. So we have Archelaus, that's his territory, the lion's share, very important. Judea, Idumea, I've mentioned before, which was where Herod the Great was originally from. Now there was, just taking a step back to look at Herod the Great, He had a historian who used to work with him, and there are scraps of evidence around of some of this historian's record of Herod the Great. And one of the things this historian says, people believe he was paid to do this, was to suggest that Herod's family tree goes back to the Babylonian Jews. And when they returned from Babylon, they, instead of coming over to Judah, they went to Idumea. And this historical record is basically that the people believe was to try and justify Herod the Great as being Jewish, going back to Babylon. But there was little of any real evidence concerning that. So back here, this is Archelaus's rule, and he was known to be a cruel ruler, vicious, from the time he came into power. As a result, he didn't reign long. He was very quickly banished and sent away because of the upset that was going on in the nation. Once you begin to oppress people too much, there is even more thought of rebellion and uprising. And that is something Rome did not want. Nobody wanted. They wanted everything to be run really, really peacefully. And so he came in with an iron fist, and it didn't go down well amongst the people at all. As a result of that, this area here loses kind of like a king type figure, and procurators and prefects take over. So now we've still got Antipas here and Philip here, who are Herod's sons, but the land of Judah particularly does not have anybody in the Herodian dynasty running it. It is, there are Roman procurators at this time, one of which was Pontius Pilate. So Pontius Pilate is not close to being Jewish. He doesn't even have conversion in his background. He is basically a Roman general or something, somebody who's been given responsibility of administrating this particular district. He has no love for the area, he has no connections, he has no ties, he doesn't care about the area at all, unlike Herod the Great, who at least had a partial affinity to the people and the region. So Pilate, as we see in the Gospels, and this is just an interesting historical type of thing, when we read the Gospels, he appears quite innocent. He's a figure who is kind of like torn. He doesn't want to crucify Jesus. He knows this is a good man, but his hand is being forced by the Jews, and that's the picture we get in the Gospels. Josephus, it's a very different picture. He's depicted as being a very evil, cruel, and harsh individual. So you've got to see how different people write about it and portray it in different ways. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that even in some areas of Orthodox churches out in the East, Pilate is almost venerated as a saint. He's seen as being so honest. But in the literature, a lot of the historians don't say anything good about him as well. So we have to try and find out what he was really like. So he's incredibly ruthless as a ruler in the sources, in the many of the historical sources. So we've got Archelaus in the New Testament. After Jesus was born, but when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judah, this is Joseph. Now Joseph he went to Bethlehem, has a baby, Herod the Great dies, so he's thinking, I can go back to Israel. But he says, when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Why was he afraid? Well, here the literary sources agree because Archelaus was incredibly harsh. And if Archelaus gets news that a supposed king was coming into his territory, it would have been very bad for him. So he was afraid to go there, and he gets the divine agreement. He was warned in a dream, and he withdrew to the district of Galilee. So not in Bethlehem, he would have been in Egypt. So he goes, instead of coming back into this territory of Archelaus, he goes up here to Galilee. And that is why he's responding to that very, very real threat. So the record of Archelaus agrees with Josephus and of Philo that this was a harsh and a cruel type of leader. These are the procurators that took place, that managed Judah, Copernicus, Marcus, Ambivalus, Annius Rufus, Valerius, Gratus, and Pontius Pilate. What we want to know here particularly is the time in which they reigned. Most of the time it's like 3 years, an 11-year stint, and a 10-year stint. This was never meant to be a permanent position. The procurators were coming towards the end of their career. Their job was to manage, to try and amass their own wealth so they could then retire. They were not invested in the land. And whenever procurators took over, ultimately they led to problems and various uprisings. It was a series of procurators over Israel, again, that led to the first revolt in AD 66. That they caused the situation again, and it was the lack of a king who's got some kind of Jewish root that holds things together that led to those rebellions. The next Herod is Herod Antipas. Who is this one here? Herod Antipas, he takes on the name of his grandfather. He originally was supposed to be the ruler. He was being groomed to take over everything, but obviously at some stage fell out of favor with his father. He has these two areas up here, one in the Galilee and one lower down here in Perea, separated by some of the Decapolis. And here is some of his coins. There are a number of coins found. And we've got, this is Herodus, Tetrarch, which they found up in the Galilee. So he printed his own money, which is a sign of fame and relative success. His territory included Galilee and Perea, and the relevance here is John the Baptist. John the Baptist's mission was around this kind of area, this side, the other side of the Jordan, around here. So this is his territory, and it would have been John the Baptist, therefore, that would have fallen under his jurisdiction, which is why we find this Herod being the one who puts him into prison. Something, one of the things he did, Sepphoris is this place up here. Sepphoris is one of those places which was a very, very important Roman city, but we never hear it mentioned in the New Testament at all. There are excellent remains there. The chances are of, and this is the argument is, that at some stage, if Jesus were a builder, the chances of Jesus having to have gone up there to work would have been very high, because during Jesus' days, this city was being built up. It was being established with houses and everything else. And if Jesus were a builder, it wouldn't have been, it's not too much, it's a probability more of, to see that he would have gone up from Nazareth to Sepphoris to help with the building work there. Purely supposition, there's nothing, there's no evidence in that whatsoever, but it is a high possibility, probability even. He also constructed a new capital of Tiberias, and I mentioned this last week. He newly constructed it, but according to Josephus, nobody wanted to live there because during the building up of the city, they found a number of Jewish graves there, and so nobody wanted to live there. And a number of Gentiles were brought there, and ultimately a number of Jews were forced to live there, but it wasn't a good experience in repopulating a city. His stronghold was in a place called Machaerus, which is way down here. You always have to have a stronghold. You always have to have, Herod the Great had Masada. You always have to have a place where if there's a war, you send your family down there so that they can be relatively safe. And it had to be relatively well defended. And it was at this particular place, these are the remains today. You can see it's up on a hill. And there's some evidence of his palace here. This makes it relatively easily defended. We see wife problems. We're going to come back to Machaerus in just a second because it has biblical relevance. But we see he left his first wife, slightly mentioned in the Gospels, but it's not going into any great detail. His first wife was Aristeus IV's daughter. And that is relevant because it looks as though there was some kind of an alliance made between the two individuals. So in divorcing this wife, he's basically cutting ties with another nation. And that caused a problem for him later on. He divorced his wife in order to marry his niece. Ah, that's not very good. And not only was it his niece, but it was also Philip's wife, his brother's wife. Not the Philip who had the northern territory we're going to speak about in a minute, but another one of his brothers called Philip. So he does three things which are really disastrously bad. He cuts off an allegiance with a neighboring kingdom. He marries his niece, biblically unkosher, nobody does that. And then he also marries his brother's wife, another thing which is biblically unkosher, and nobody does that. So these things together created a degree of enmity between Herod Antipas and the people. And so there was a large amount of tension between them, and a number of people criticized him very, very heavily, not least of which was John the Baptist, who sees that, understands the situation. So with many other exhortations, he preached good news to the people. This is John. But Herod the Tetrarch, this is Herod Antipas. Herod the Tetrarch, who had been reproved by John for Herodias, his brother's wife, and for all the evil things that Herod had done. And don't forget this, we know about Herodias, we often think about that, but we also know for the evil things that Herod had done, such as cutting off this relationship with Aristeas. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes, yes. He had a lot of brothers and sisters. He had a bunch of brothers and sisters. Yes. He met this woman, first of all, in Rome, when he was in Rome. And then afterwards, they got married. But it obviously wasn't the done thing to do at the time. But it's not that Philip. Yeah. Yes, this is collaborated by Josephus. It speaks about Antipas not being popular with his subjects. It goes into more detail about the Aristeas and the battle that ensues afterwards, a lot of it. But yes, a lot of this it collaborates well with Josephus. Yeah. I should have got the references. If I can find the references, I'll see if I can find you the references. That lends into it. It's quite a long section. He goes into quite a lot of detail about this whole scenario. Machaerus is the place, by the way, this is the place where, whoops, This is the place where John the Baptist was held, and this is the place where he was actually killed. This stronghold where that whole dance thing went on. His wife said, just, you know, give me his head on a platter. And that's what he did. Okay, so Aristeus, Aretas, as a result of this and growing tensions, he the Nabataeans, I believe, they actually attack. And there is, around about the time of the Gospels, there is a war, high tensions and a war that takes place between Herod and Nabatea. But we don't read about it because it's not in the Gospels' intent. We kind of get the feeling, as we read through the Gospels, that war is not happening at all. And part of that is the Pax Romana, but there were huge tensions going on around the area between different peoples at that time. It wasn't as quite a period of peace, entire peace, as one might think. Herod, again, he has some respect for Jewish tradition. Apparently, he goes down to Jerusalem for the feasts. This is something we don't have from the procurators. They don't care about any of that stuff. They just want to do their time, get their money, and get out. But Herod has kind of like an affinity to what's going on, and he does, obviously with John condemning him, he does have some kind of respect for the Torah. He knows he's doing something wrong, so he does have some connection with the Judaism of that particular day. Towards the end of his life, he becomes jealous of his nephew Agrippa I, because Agrippa I begins amassing territory, and he begins pulling his influences in Rome and gaining a large amount of popularity from amongst the Romans. So he's gaining a lot of momentum, and there are lots of accusations between Agrippa and Antipas, and ultimately Agrippa and his people, they accuse Antipas of amassing weapons and amassing soldiers to fight against the Roman Empire, to overthrow them and to lead the country. I told you, the idea of uprising is always on the forefront of people's mind. As a result of this, he's exiled to Lugdunum, which is, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's in Gaul, it's in France somewhere. He was taken away from there. Agrippa was ultimately believed. And so he loses his land. Agrippa gradually takes hold of these pieces of land, and he does, as we'll see, end up controlling a large portion of the country, the whole thing, in fact. We have this reference of Herod Antipas in the Gospels. And that's the very hour some Pharisees came and said to him, to Jesus, get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. I raised that last week in the context of Pharisees wanting to help Jesus. He said to them, go and tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today, and tomorrow and the third day I finish my course. So we have this a passage which has been spoken about quite a lot concerning the imagery of the fox. Don't forget, we're dealing with Herod Antipas in this case, not Herod the Great. And in understanding it, there are at least three opinions which I lay down at your feet to think about. The first one is the question of calling Herod cunning. The idea of the fox imagery is that of being a metaphor for being cunning as we have it today. And some would argue that this is a question or a case of Herod. If you look at all the three brothers, Herod is the last man standing. Philip would have already passed away, lost his territory. Archelaus would have been thrown out. And so now he's the last man standing. So some people think that he was exceptionally cunning to remain standing that day. Another image is the question of red. Foxes that certainly we see around here today are red. And what has red got to do with anything? Well, where was what's Herod's ancestry? It's supposed to be from Idumea, which is close to or related to ancient Edom. And Edom, as you know, I'm sure, is the Hebrew word for red, and it's related to Esau, wanting that red potage. So some people say that it's calling it a fox for those reasons. But if we go, and this is what I encourage, wherever possible, this type of imagery, we need to go back to find out how is the word fox used in rabbinic literature, or in the literature of the period, in order to get a better idea of what's being spoken of here. And when we look at the word, at the fox in rabbinic literature, which again, I'm talking about early rabbinic literature, we're dealing with the period of the first, second century. The idea of fox is about somebody primarily who is impotent as well as being worthless. Somebody that is of no threat whatsoever. This depiction of Herod Antipas, I think, is more relevant in the immediate contact text, because what is Jesus saying? He's saying, I'm casting out demons and I'm doing what I do today, tomorrow. I'm going to carry on with what I'm doing, and there's nothing you can do to stop me, even if you do call yourself a king. And that's the statement being made here, and it is indeed what Jesus actually does. So Jesus is trying to say, you know, Herod, you're not going to stop me. I'm going to finish my course. I've got a purpose to fulfill, and I'm going to actually do it. Because we know as well from other accounts in the Gospels that Herod Antipas, wanted to get hold of Jesus to see him perform some kind of a miracle, or he maybe just wanted to hold him as he did with John, because that may have been the same way that John the Baptist may have been caught out. So we see this reference here, and possibly with some rabbinic references, we can get a clearer view of the meaning of that particular text. Jesus continues ministry. I mentioned that here because contextually, this statement is so important. He performed cures today and tomorrow and the third day. I finished my course. I'm going to the end of my ministry, irrespective of you wanting to kill me. You will not do it. So it's a question of impotence which is being raised at this particular point. That brings us to Herod Philip. We looked at Archelaus, short rule, thrown out of Judah. Antipas, longer rule. And then we have Philip the Tetrarch. He is given, we don't know much about him, not mentioned much in the Gospels, but he's basically given the land of Iturea, which is predominantly Gentile. Predominantly Gentile. We have so little information of what was going on there. Jesus seldom really goes here. Much of Jesus' ministry obviously is in the Galilee with Antipas, and then down in Judea, which is down here. Skipping the land of the land of the Samaritans for the most part. So that's the area and that's the region he is actually given, which is mainly Gentile. Now, was Philip thrust up here because he had still had some Idumean blood, and Herod just wanted him to be as far away from everything else as possible? I don't know. But that nevertheless is the makeup of his territory. This picture here, a bit faint, is that of Banias, where there is this huge temple of Pan, and there also it's one of the sources of the Jordan as well, and this was part of Herod's territory. He built this up, this place Banias, which is also called, this is the place we're talking about, called Caesarea Philippi. This was the place that Jesus did actually go to. There was a huge temple of Pan. Like I said, there were idols and statues. These are the remains of it now. It's actually, you know, it's a nice kind of peacefulish place to go to. But he built this area up, and he expanded Bethsaida, which was slightly down the other side of the Galilee. He had a degree of influence on that region as well. He died childless, however, and his territory, instead of going to any of his kids, which he couldn't do, it was adopted, absorbed into the Syrian territory. But later on, King Agrippa gets that territory and he manages that for a while. That was one of the first areas that King Agrippa I was able to control, and as his influence grew in Rome, he was given more and more land. Luke 3:1, we find our mention in the New Testament of this individual. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor over Judea. Now I've mentioned that. Pilate had taken over here at that time because Archelaus was not such a great ruler. We have Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea. And Iturea is this up here. We've got the name just up there. We have Iturea and Trachonitis and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene. So we've got this reference here for the for this particular Herod, tetrarch. This particular Herod, Herod Philip, being managing the land here. So we've seen three different Herods mentioned in the New Testament, in the Gospel accounts, four, including Herod the Great, and they are all different individuals. It's not the same person at all. This here again is part of his region. This is the springs at Banias. This is one of the sources of the Jordan. And this is all personal opinion right now, that I think this was a holiday destination for Jesus. When Jesus was tired of the desert heat, he was tired of the agro in the Galilee, I think they came up here to Caesarea Philippi. We have this account when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked the disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" So we find Jesus up in Caesarea when it's just him and his disciples. This is vacation, I'm sure it is. The heat of the summer is too much for him. He goes up and it's absolutely beautiful. It's a nice, a lovely walk down the stream. It's cool, it's shaded, it's lovely. It's a place where if I had disciples, it's a place I would go to talk to them and to teach them more on various issues. So that's what we happen here. This is one place the area of Israel that was controlled by Philip, by Herod, that we find Jesus in. Moving on from this, so we've looked at Philip. Not much was actually mentioned there. We now have Herod Agrippa. We move to the grandson of Herod the Great. Herod's grandson. He actually began his life, he was a bit of a rogue. He spent money wild and recklessly and ended up owing lots of people money, but he had very strong connections in Rome, which covers over a multitude of sins. We're looking at Herod's grandson. And when he got older, he began to have aspirations of controlling the land of his grandfather once again, unifying everything. Now, once we're talking again about a Herod, even though he's not fully Jewish, he does have some kind of a affinity to the people, to the Jewish people, to the customs and everything else. As I'm saying, some kind of, he wasn't, you know, fully sold out, but he had more so than just the procurators. Educated in Rome, I mentioned before, the children of Herod, born, you go off to Rome, that's where you are educated, and that's when you build up your connections with Roman aristocracy. He is given territory. Ultimately, he is given all of this territory at the end, towards the end of his reign. This is what he has, which is darn near close to what his grandfather actually had. So he succeeded pretty much in that. He received Philip's Tetrarchy first up here. He received Galilee and Perea after Antipas, him and Antipas had that conflict. Antipas was exiled and he got that land too. And ultimately he was awarded Herod's territory, or most of Herod's territory, not exactly all of it. So he was kind of like, he did inherit a great deal, and he was able to kind of reunite things under a single head once again. He also kind of tried to embark on a series of building programs. Perhaps for us the most significant thing he did was, this is Jerusalem. I'll be doing this, showing you this slide again and again. I'm sorry it's blurred. There are better ones. But like I say, this was the Hasmonean Wall. There was Herod the Great's second wall. And then he began building this wall here. And I say he began building it. He never actually finished. This is called the third wall. He never actually finished building it because he was accused of trying to overthrow the Roman government. And so he had to stop because it looks like he was building, fortifying Jerusalem as his capital. So he was responsible for that third wall. In the Bible, he mistreats the church. And this is in Acts, not in the Gospels. At that time, Herod the king, and again, we don't know, we don't have the markers in Scripture, and it's unfortunate. So we just see Herod. So some people I've heard some people actually think this is Herod the Great, but it's not. It's a couple generations down from him. At that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter. So this is kind of an important scripture because it shows some history towards his connection with the Jews. At this time, we're looking really at the early church building up. They were beginning to separate more and more from the from regular mainstream Judaism. This was a slow process, and it's not 100% clear either. We find Peter in this particular case being arrested and thrown into prison because he's part of this sect, the followers of the way. But we see that, but we also have to consider when Paul is carrying out his persecution, Peter is never touched. He's never touched at all. So there's obviously some kind of, I don't understand exactly what's going on, but it looks as though Peter was still seen as somehow being within mainstream Judaism to some degree at least. Putting all that aside, Agrippa, he puts Peter in prison, but if you remember this story, but the disciples pray for Peter and he is escorted out of his prison cell via an angel, so he's ultimately saved. But it's this Herod Agrippa who seemed to be vindictive towards the followers of the way. His death is attributed to divine retribution, and this is another instance in which we have a historical record matching quite closely with the gospel records. Now, I'm not saying that's the only way we can prove the gospel record somehow, but I'm saying when these things come together, it is quite nice, and we should appreciate it at least. This is the account of his death in Acts. This was a guy, don't forget, who was able to reestablish the kingdom, to gain most of Herod's kingdom again. So he would have had a certain view or perception of himself. Now after Herod searched him, didn't find him, examined, we go down, he goes to Caesarea, and all the points, he comes out in all of his robes, takes his seat, delivers an oration, and the people are shouting, "The voice of a God and not of a man." Immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. So it looks as though there's some kind of a supernatural, whatever that means, some kind of intervention by God to strike him down. That's the account we have in the book of Acts. And Josephus Antiquities says something very similar. Presently his flatterers cried out, one from one place and another from another, though not for his good, that he was a god. So it's the same thing being said by Josephus, and they added, upon this the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. Just like the record in Acts, a severe pain also arose in his belly and began in a most violent manner. And then Josephus goes on to speak about his weird death. So we've got these two separate sources, one from Luke, one from Josephus, that really match, that speak, that seem to really testify that Herod Agrippa's the first death was horribly violent and was caused directly by God because of his pride. But as I mentioned before, we shouldn't be looking to prove the New Testament with external sources, but accept what is written there within. And then this brings me, and I'll finish this with this, we'll pause for a while. This brings me to Agrippa's son. Agrippa's son, Agrippa II, was too young to reign, to rule in place of his father. So he doesn't take on the whole of the nation. Once again, Israel is given into the hands of Roman procurators. And this naturally causes problems, because it's the next series of procurators that lead us into the first revolt in 66 AD. He is mentioned in Acts, Agrippa II, here. Now, in spite of what's said here, he wasn't really a king at all, because there were procurators around at the time. So the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in, and Festus said, "King Agrippa and all who are present with you, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not live any longer." So we've got Paul coming into before Agrippa, and as I said before, he's called king, but it's not like he was Agrippa the First by any stretch of the imagination. Agrippa the Second had quite a different rule. He was more of a peacemaker. We find in Josephus' account of the revolt that we find him going backwards and forwards between the Jews and the Romans, trying to broker a deal and trying to slow things down as much as he could. So he's not a proper king, but certainly addressed that way, he was still very important. He also has a very strange relationship with Bernice, his sister, who goes with him everywhere. And Josephus has, you know, lots to say about that relationship. Ultimately, he was overthrown in 66, which is the year of the Great Revolt. That was the time in which, under a procurator down in Caesarea Maritima, there was an issue over a synagogue, and it began as a small scuffle, but because of the tensions that were around between the Romans and the Jews, it exploded, it caught fire, and we end up with this huge scale revolt, which begins in 66, and it's ultimately ended in 70, when Rome comes with a heavy hand, Vespasian comes with a heavy hand, and destroys Jerusalem. With that said, I think we can pause. It's a natural pause. We've been gone about another hour. And we'll come back and start talking about Second Temple Jerusalem before we talk about the temple and more about Jesus' healing. Teaching, sorry. So let's take 10 minutes. I can see everyone's like, it's like my students get there.